It's really nice to be here, and I am going to talk about Rasmiya's case, but in order to best introduce my involvement in her defense work, I'm going to talk about myself. I'm a member of a group called the Committee to Stop FBI Repression, and that was an organization that was created in the wake of FBI raids of homes and offices of peace groups in Chicago and the Twin Cities and Grand Rapids, Michigan, that took place on September 24th, 2010. I was living in Logan Square at the time, had been living there for over 20 years. One morning, there was a knock on our door at 7 a.m., and when I came downstairs, there were half a dozen people standing on our front porch, and I opened the door, and the man in front, young guy, looked like a, you know, I don't know, late 20s, kind of dressed in office casual, except for the bulge over his left breast, handed me a warrant to search our home, saying that my ex-wife, my wife at the time, and I were under investigation for conspiracy to provide material support to foreign terrorist organizations in Palestine and in Colombia. And at the moment that they were raiding our house, they were raiding six other homes as well as visiting other activists in Wisconsin, in North Carolina, and in California, and in Arizona. Altogether, there were over 70 special agents in the field that morning from six different U.S. attorney districts. It was the largest mobilization or deployment of FBI agents for a political case since COINTELPRO, since you know, the early 1970s. And we, after they handed us the warrant, they then handed us subpoenas saying that we were required to appear in front of a federal grand jury investigating these same allegations. The first six FBI agents that came in my house were followed by 10 more. So there were 16 agents searching our home, and they allowed us to stay, but they took our cell phones, they took our computers. Actually, they didn't take our computers. They had this machine that they popped open the hard drives out of our computers and put them into these machines, which mirrored, not just copied, but mirrored the contents of our hard drives. Anyway, we were allowed to stay in the house, but they proceeded to search every room of our home. And they arrived at 7 in the morning, and they did not leave until 6:30 in the evening. And when they left, they took 30 boxes of our files. My ex and I are both archivists, or pack rats, however you want to look at it. And they took... they took lots of notebooks. They were especially interested in things with our handwriting in them. And they were also especially interested in any scrap of paper that had a name and a phone number or an email on it. So they took every petition that they could find in the house and every sign-in list from every event we had ever organized that we didn't throw away. I'm sure they got your name, Rita, because I remember when your daughter sat in at Cicero, right?
Morton West,
that's right, against military recruitment. Was that what it was?
And the Iraq War.
And during the Iraq War, yeah, against the Iraq War. And I remember talking to you. I know I had your name and phone number in one of my notebooks, so it's in their database now. And then, you know, we basically were, it took us a while because we didn't have cell phones, it took us a while to figure out, like, how many people were being raided and what was happening around the country. And And then, you know, within a couple of hours, we figured out, well, the only thing that all, that morning there were 14 people, no, 11 people that were subpoenaed to the grand jury. And the only thing that we all had done together was we had been the among the coordinators of the last big march against the Iraq War, which was at the Republican National Convention in St. Paul, Minnesota, on Labor Day of 2008. And so in the weeks that followed that, we were able to piece together that during the organizing for that march, the FBI and the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which labels any national march at any of the RNCs or DNCs or, you know, any march on Washington, they label them as national security events, which then justifies sending in the Joint Terrorism Task Force to send in undercover officers. And the peace coalition that we had formed had been infiltrated by at least two undercover agents. So when the protest happened, there were a bunch of young people, anarchists and anti-authoritarians, who were also infiltrated, and they got charges, you know, which were mostly, they got terrorism charges, which were all dismissed. But like the NATO 3 here were very similar. But we didn't have any charges at the protest itself. And then 2 years later, the FBI showed up at our door, and these the undercovers that infiltrated us, they stuck around. They became core activists in the anti-war movement for 2.5 years. And it was based on the fantastic lies that they told about us. Gun training?
Really?
Gun training? That's what we were engaged in? Among other things. It was based on these fantastic lies that these two women told about us. 40-year-old lesbians, you know, who would have guessed? I'm laughing about it now, but it was really, really stressful because, so they subpoenaed us to a grand jury, and you know, I didn't really understand how a grand jury worked until I was subpoenaed to one, and then the National Lawyers Guild lawyers explained to us that that a prosecutor can get a grand jury to do whatever they want them to do. It is not a jury like, you know, like we think of, where you have, you know, a jury of your peers. You know, your lawyer does not have the right to object to who they put on the grand jury. It's entirely selected by the prosecutor. There is no judge in a grand jury. It's just the prosecutor and 23 people that they picked without any input from the defense. You don't have the right to present a defense. You don't have the right to question any witness that they bring against you. You don't have the right to see any evidence that they have to present against you. It's you know, like the Star Chamber. Yeah, it's a kangaroo court. And what did they want to ask us about? They wanted to ask us about, you know, our solidarity work with Palestine and people in Colombia. And, you know, we were always very open about our sympathies. But what they were suggesting we did was provide material support, which means money. And, you know, that's illegal. We knew it was illegal, and so, you know, we never tried to do it. So they said, we want you to come in and testify to this grand jury. But, you know, obviously in the U.S., if you go in and talk to a grand jury, you know, your fellow activists might be, brought in for interrogation. But in Palestine, if they were able to link us to anyone in Palestine, in Palestine they don't interrogate them, they torture them, or they kill them. And in Colombia, it's the same thing. It's, you know, it's the most brutal counterinsurgency war in the world. So we said, at that first weekend, there were 14, and then eventually they subpoenaed 9 more for a total of 23 people. It's the largest case of a political, largest political case in the country since the Black Panther 21. And And all 23 of us agreed that we were not going to appear in front of that grand jury. And each one of us then had to deal with the consequences of that. The consequences are that you can be imprisoned for up to 18 months for simply taking your Fifth Amendment right not to self-incriminate. Because in front of a grand jury, you don't have your Fifth Amendment right. You cannot refuse to testify. If you do, the judge says, well, you're guilty of contempt of court. Has anybody seen the Trumbo movie? Oh, I highly recommend it. It's the same principle. In front of one of these witch hunts, you don't have the right not to self-incriminate. So they never brought charges against us. And we were able to build an enormous support movement for us because, you know, the people that they raided and subpoenaed, we were all veteran, or most of us were veteran activists. That's how I met Dale in the defense committee that we formed. We eventually got unions representing over 1 million workers to pass resolutions in our defense. We got 14 members of Congress to write letters to Eric Holder saying, essentially, you've got the wrong people. And it actually revived the peace movement in Chicago, which had been in pretty sick shape prior to us being raided. And as a result of that, like, we were asked to coordinate the march against NATO, you know, 2 years later. So anyway, so it just seemed like this just insane witch hunt. And, you know, now here we are over 5 years later. They've never charged any of us. It appears that they didn't have the smoking gun that they were looking for. We're all still, you know, basically leading our lives. And that would be, you know, kind of like we're looking at the end of this story, except they used the investigation of us digging through our lives to go after two veterans of the movement. The first person they went after was one of the speakers at that protest at the RNC. In 2008, was one of the founders of the Brown Berets. He's a guy named Carlos Montes, and he's iconic in Los Angeles. Like, every Chicano studies course in America teaches who Carlos Montes is. You know, he's like, you know, the Huey Newton or Bobby Seale of the Chicano youth movement of the late 60s. And they dug through his life until they found an unresolved court case from 1969 in which he was accused of throwing a pop can at a cop. And then he actually fled. He went underground. He came back 7 years later and got it settled as a misdemeanor. But the FBI said, no, you're a felon and you've never stood trial for this. So we're going to put you on trial and threaten him with 22 years in prison for avoiding the law. So we had to defend him. And that took a year. And tens of thousands of dollars. And we beat him. We beat the charges. But then, 6 months after we beat those charges, Resmia Oda, who's a friend of ours here in Chicago, I've known her since 2004, one morning in October of 2013, Department of Homeland Security knocks on her door in Evergreen Park and says, you know, you're under arrest. And they brought her in front of the U.S. attorney, the federal court here in Chicago, and said, and the charge against her was that she had falsely acquired citizenship because she failed to reveal that she was actually a high-level terrorist in Palestine. So this is the story, and I'm sorry about that long-winded introduction, but like, I just want you to understand, like, this is not just a case that I care about. This is my case. They found her digging through the lives and the files of the activists. She was in all of our cell phones. I have lots of meetings I had been at with her. You know, and Stephanie, my ex-wife, did as well, and many of the other activists. And she was working with Hatem Abudeya, who was, you know, the director of the Arab American Action Network, and they raided his house. So I can imagine the frustration of the U.S. attorneys that they spent millions of dollars investigating the 23 of us and didn't even get to go to court, right? What a what a frustrating thing for these, you know, these gunslingers. So they want somebody to put on trial. So they found this dangerous person. So what's the basis of their charges against her? In 1969, Rasmiya was arrested in Jerusalem, along with 500 other people in her neighborhood. She was 21 years old. You know, her family had been, you know, one of the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands that were displaced by the, you know, the founding of the State of Israel. And then she was, you know, she lived in a refugee camp, and then she was eventually living in the West Bank. And when they arrested those 500 people, why? There had been a bombing in Jerusalem the previous night. And so they went looking for someone that they could say was the bomber. They arrested her, and they took her to, you know, this is a military occupation. These are soldiers. And they take her to a military prison where they tortured her. And, you know, I never knew what they had done to her until, you know, I've known her since, like I said, for over 10 years. Some of the other Palestinians had always said, you know, she was a victim of torture, but I'd never actually asked her or read what the Israeli soldiers did to her, and it's bestial. And they raped her, they used electric shock, and the thing that finally made her crack and sign the confession that she had done this bombing was they brought her father in and raped her in front of her father. And at that point she just said, I will sign anything. Also, they had not allowed her to see a lawyer, and they didn't allow her to see a lawyer for almost 2 months. And as soon as she got a lawyer in her cell, she said, it's a lie. I didn't do this. I was tortured into signing this confession. And she has maintained that innocence for 46 years. When she was released from prison, she was given a life sentence, but then she was, you know, released in a prisoner exchange 10 years later. She went directly to the United Nations Special Commission on Torture and testified and told all of this. And if you have the stomach to read it, it's all online. Her dad was an American citizen. He was an auto worker in Dearborn. And some years later, she was, you know, living and working in Jordan. Her dad got sick, and her brother, also an American citizen, also living in Dearborn, said, you know, you don't have any kids. Can you come to Dearborn and take care of dad? So she did. She applied for a visa, and then she was here for 10 years, and she applied for citizenship, and it was awarded to her. This woman is famous in Palestine. She has been since the moment her trial, I mean, her case became public. She's a famous political prisoner. The U.S. government knew who she was. She testified in front of the UN. The whole legal structure of the American foreign policy knew who she was. And they allowed her to emigrate, and they allowed her to obtain citizenship. And 10 years later, they said, oh, well, we reviewed your case, and you lied on your application for citizenship because you didn't tell us you are a terrorist. And she said, I'm not a terrorist. I'm a victim. And on the application, it says, you know, have you ever been convicted of a crime? And, you know, she answered no. And I'll explain that in a minute, you know, why she answered it that way. So they arrested her, they put her on trial, and then they convicted her of falsely acquiring citizenship. And that was in the fall of 2014. So her lawyers applied for... you know, they filed an appeal, and the appeal was finally heard this fall. And this is the basis of the appeal. First of all, she was denied her defense. This is in the Constitution. You have the right to present the defense, you know, the best defense that you can. Well, her best defense is that she's the victim. She's not a terrorist. She was tortured into this confession. The judge ruled that she would not be allowed to use the word torture or to talk about anything that happened to her in prison in Israel. Would not allow it. The judge also allowed the prosecution in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Eastern Michigan, in Detroit, they were allowed to talk about the crimes that she had committed. And they were allowed to present evidence from the same Israeli court that she was not allowed to mention. And more, even more pertinent to U.S. jurisprudence, all of these years, Rasmiya has never gone to therapy. You know, for those of us in our culture, that's pretty shocking. But, you know, for most cultures in the world, therapy is something that, you know, they don't do. So when faced with, you know, prison and deportation, her lawyers said, you know, we have to get you to talk to an expert. So she went to the Kobler Center. And, you know, one of the PhDs there said, this woman is the victim of torture. And that doctor, Mary Masri, I'm forgetting her name right now, we got the judge to agree to have her testify, not in front of a jury, but just in front of the judge in Detroit. And the judge initially agreed that the jury would be allowed to hear that testimony. And then the prosecution objected, and the judge overturned his own decision. And so, again, Rasmiya was denied her defense. And then, not only was she denied her defense, the prosecution submitted documents and testimony and evidence obtained, not just that was tortured out of her. This is evidence from the Israeli military occupation force in the West Bank. This is an illegal occupation. This is a military occupation that has been condemned. I mean, it can't go to the World Court because the U.S. won't allow it in front of the World Court, but it has been condemned by 97% of the country, the countries representing 97% of humanity. The occupation of Palestine is illegal. And yet, you know, our government says this is valid evidence, and we're not allowed in our court system to consider evidence based on torture. Well, unless it comes from the Israelis, in which case we will consider evidence such as that. So this is where the case stands. She had her appeal hearing. She's presented it in front of the Sixth District Court in Cincinnati. This was in October. And we are waiting for a decision. There's a three-judge panel out of the seven, I guess, in that district who are reviewing her case. And a decision could be handed down at any time. Her defense committee, which, you know, I'm a part of, our intention is that if she's not, the two things that the best case scenarios are, one, that she would be given a new evidentiary hearing in front of the same judge and allowed to present the evidence the defense that she was denied, or at least to present the PTSD expert. The second option possibility is that she'd be given a new trial, although it is almost certain that it would be in front of the same judge. And then, you know, if she's denied, if they deny her either of those, her lawyers have the option to appeal to the whole circuit court, like the all the judges, or to take it to the Supreme Court. And I'm not a lawyer, so I don't exactly know what all of their thinking is, but those are the options. And in the meantime, what we do is we continue to, you know, to spread the word and tell this story and appeal for support. And I just want to say that, you know, for our organization, the Committee to Stop FBI Repression, we have a website which is very easy to remember. It's stopfbi.net. And you can go there and sign up for the email list. And, you know, we do not send we don't bombard people. It's like, you know, during the trial, it was like one update a week, and now it's about one update a month. You can also read the 5 years of historical documents from our case and from Resmia's case there. I actually brought one piece of literature, which is an article that was printed in a little newspaper I write for, Fight Back News, that came out just before her appeal in October. But it's got all the legal arguments that I'm talking about. So and then of course, you know, this defense has cost us somewhere in the order of $100,000. So anyone that can make a contribution, you can make contributions online at stopfbi.net. Or if you want to give me a check, I'll take a check made to CSFR. And I think I'm going to stop there, because I think I went over my 20 minutes.
So. No, you're perfect.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. I'm going to pass this microphone around for questions. One thing that I would like you to address, one of the points was that she was only in custody for a day before she confessed, and so that belies her testimony that said that she was tortured for weeks. I'm just pulling that out as one of the things.
Sure.
And this was an article that Laurel sent around, so I'm wondering that other
sure.
people might have questions about it, so I want you to address that.
Sure. It is true that she signed that confession after a little more than 24 hours. The bestiality that I described, that's how long it took to crack her. She was, however, denied to see a lawyer for 45 days. She was put in terrible state, you know, awful prison, and after having been, you know, raped and tortured by those men, being held in that same area by those same men, the United Nations definition of torture includes the ongoing imprisonment by torturers. So it's not incorrect to say she was in conditions of torture for 45 days.
I want to understand the evidence at the trial. So what it seems to me is that the government is saying, well, maybe you were tortured, maybe we can accept that for purposes of argument, but why did you lie in the form? Why didn't you say, yes, convicted, yes, see attached explanation, and blah, 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 I don't recognize the legitimacy of my own conviction. Mm-hmm. So how did she deal with that at the mm-hmm. trial? Was there some kind of like psychological evidence that
she wasn't allowed to present the psychological evidence? That's what the PTSD expert from the Kobler Center was going to talk about. Okay. So PTSD has a number. I actually sat through all the proceedings and heard the arguments from heard the presentation from her doctor. What Dr. Massery said is, PTSD manifests itself in a variety of ways. And one of the things that is very common is for things to trigger the PTSD. And in particular, being asked to recall what happened to you, or being confronted with the need to talk about it or write about it, or like make statements about it, is a very common trigger. And Dr. Masri's argument dovetails with what Rasmiya has said in her, what she said in her testimony, which is she read the application for, you know, for a visa and the application for citizenship, and they have a question on it. It says, have you ever been convicted of a crime? Well, when she read it, you know, she had been, you know, living in Jordan for 15 years and, you know, went on her application for a visa, and she said, well, no, I've never been convicted of a crime. And when she applied for citizenship, it said, have you ever spent time in prison? And she said, what, in the U.S.? No, I've been living here for 10 years as a, you know, upstanding, you know, resident. So in her mind, they weren't asking her about the torture and about the imprisonment, the illegal imprisonment by the Israelis. You know, that's how she thought about it. That's what she said when she was first arrested. And then, you know, she went through 3 or 4 months of psychological evaluation, and the doctor from the Kobler Center said, we think this is a credible statement of how she responded to those questions. But it doesn't really matter what the doctor thought, because the jury never got to hear this. And it's just so remarkable, too, that the judge was going to allow the testimony to be heard. And such evidence of the collusion between the judiciary, you know, the judicial wing of the Justice Department and the prosecutorial wing. The judge had already ruled. And the next appearance in court, the prosecution gets up and says, Judge, I don't think I argued, literally, this is what the man said, I don't think I argued very well, you know, my argument about why you shouldn't allow the jury to hear the testimony from this this expert. I'd like another bite at the apple. I'd like to make the argument again. The judge let him make the argument and then reversed himself. Mm-hmm. And all he did was repeat what he had said in the first appearance. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what happened in the judge's chambers, you know, that the people sitting in the courtroom didn't get to see? Well, you know, we may never know, but it was just, it was really quite eye-opening for me, quite revealing.
Have you noticed Rasmiya's photo next to a man who has spoken at our forums, Frank Chapman, of the Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression? And Rasmiya is Shiro of that group. And Frank leads our Monday evening at
1325 South Wabash, Suite 105.
Yeah, right. At 6 o'clock.
There's like six different groups Monday that share that little closeted space. I just want to say one thing though in response to Jerry pointing out that photo. The other person in that photo is of course the iconic Angela Davis, and it must be galling. I hope it's galling to the prosecutors in this case that this woman who they have targeted and whose life they're attempting to ruin has become famous to a new generation, not just of Palestinians, but to the movement in the U.S. Not only did Angela also submit, by the way, an op-ed piece to the Detroit Free Press just prior to Rasmiya's trial, in which Angela said, if you supported me when I was on trial, you have to support Rasmiya. But since then, Rasmiya has been embraced by the Black Lives Matter movement. A video was released just at the time of her appeal, in which when you see the video on YouTube, the image is her, Danny Glover, and one of the women that founded the Black Lives Matter movement, like the three of them and you click on it, and there's like, you know, it's like 4 or 5 minutes of poetry and images of protest, and Rasmiya's image and the image of Palestine is like woven together. It's in a sense, it's backfired in the faces of the U.S. attorney, as it backfired on them when they raided and subpoenaed us. I believe that, you know, the hardcore Zionists that are, you know, part of the Department of Justice, I believe that when they raided us, I mean, the night we were raided, our home was on the front, the raids of us were the top story on every TV station in Chicago that night. And we were on the front page of the Tribune and the Sun-Times. We were, you know, on page 7 of the New York Times. But front page story, you know, FBI investigation of terrorists in Chicago. And I remember watching the ABC News in particular. They say, there's an FBI investigation of a potential terrorist activity in Chicago. And then they flash on the screen the name of the political group I'm part of, Freedom Road Socialist Organization, with a red backing. And then they showed a picture of my house. And that was, I couldn't stand to flip through the other channels. I was so freaked out. And I thought, you know, Stephanie and I are going to prison. You know, that's what I thought at that moment. But the next morning when we got back to our house, and we fled the house, we were so freaked out, we went and stayed at a friend's house. We got back to the house the next morning, sitting on our step, our front step, were three, were flowers. There was some cut flowers that was left by Laura Paz. There was a growing plant, I can't remember what it was, left by some other friends of parents of our kids. Classmates, and there was an orchid that had been left a growing orchid that had been left with a little card that said, "Dear Joe and Stephanie, our family loves your family," and it was signed Omida and Jessica Gutierrez, the daughters of the congressman. Mm. And at that moment, I said, "Well, maybe we're not going to prison."
Dress. Role of the Zionists infiltrating the Justice Department and universities. Stephen Salaita's case at University of Illinois Champaign comes to mind. Can you speak to that kind of influence that they've had in corrupting the Justice Department to the extent that it's being used to target political activists who are challenging the Zionist settler project called Israel?
Yeah, I addressed briefly the how it manifested itself in Rasmiya's trial, the collusion between the U.S. attorney in Detroit and the judge. There are, you know, there are so many examples that you can point to. The main one is that you know, there are scores of Arab and Muslim. Mostly men, some women, who are sitting in prison. I think everybody here, well, it's likely you've heard about the cases of the entrapped young men who are usually kind of, you know, unhealthy psychologically, who get like drawn into, you know, planting fake bombs. This has happened a lot. But less well known are the cases of the Muslim philanthropic organizations. The Holy Land Five is just shocking. Right after 9/11, the U.S. government went after the largest Muslim foundation in America, and the five men who headed it were put on trial and convicted of providing material support to a foreign terrorist organization. And what had they been doing? They'd been providing food and medical care to the wrong children. The children of Gaza. And in order to get money to the children of Gaza, it has to go through organizations, the Zakat committees. It's basically like, you know, I don't know how the Unitarians work, but I grew up Catholic. You know, there's a Catholic charity arm, right, that handles the money that goes to, you know, feed kids in the third world and whatnot. And these men got 65-year sentences for doing this. And the man who prosecuted them is the guy who's investigating us, Barry Jonas. This is his career. This is what he's done in the Department of Justice for the last 15 years. He hunts Muslims, and he hunts people who get too close to Muslims. And we are his other biggest case, and we've denied him a victory so far. We feel pretty proud of ourselves.
I think there are terrorists out there, and I think it's kind of scary and crazy that the government is spending all this money on people who aren't terrorists. I suppose that's, I don't know, maybe they think these are the low-lying fruit or something, but it's scary that there are real terrorists who are probably going to get away with things because they're running around chasing these innocent activists.
Well, I think that it's... it's pretty clear that there are organizations, military organizations in the world that use terror. The largest of them, the best known of them, receive an enormous amount of support from the U.S. Foreign policy apparatus. I mean, you know, I traveled to Syria a year and a half ago to go observe the elections there. Everyone in Syria knew that ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Syria were fighting with American weapons. They were getting intelligence from American, from the CIA in Jordan. You know, everybody talks about this joke that there are 50 trained moderate Syrian rebels that the U.S. spent $500 million. But it's an open secret that the U.S. spent $10 billion in Jordan training people who are mostly today fighting with ISIS and the al-Nusra Front. So the whole war on terror has a number of layers to it, but one of the things that it has is to install fear in the American people. And there's the broad fear that gets people not to question what the government is doing, but then there's a targeted fear where they come after the movement. And they say, essentially, the message to the movement is, if you dare express sympathy with the oppressed people of the world, this is what's going to happen to you. And that's why one of our messages to anyone who gets visited by the FBI is, don't keep it to yourself. This operation, this repression of the movement, this needs disinfectant. This needs sunlight. We have to speak up, and we can't remain silent.
On that note, can everybody give him a round of applause?
Thank you.